Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We are tracking the fallout from this week's shooting in a Seattle homeless encampment. Two people killed, three wounded, and it happened just as Seattle's mayor was calling for a new approach to homelessness. We're going to talk with the mayor in just a moment. First, we hear reaction from people who sell the weekly street newspaper Real Change. Many of these vendors are homeless or have been. They know about this encampment where the shooting happened in a lot near the I-5 and I-90 freeways, a place known as the jungle.
I was really concerned because I have friends up there, and it's not a safe place for anybody, but where are the homeless going to go? I mean, then they said that the DOC and the cops are going to push everybody out. Where are they going to go? Me and my boyfriend have a hard time because we both have criminal history. And it's hard to get a place because we lived in a tent. And, you know, you got to watch your back when you're in a tent. People try to burn the tents down with people in them. I mean, the jungle's not a safe place, but I don't know what they're supposed to do.
So I've been in the jungle before, and it's not a real nice place, not even for men. But the thing is, you know, everybody knows what goes on in the jungle out there. You know what I'm saying? There's drug dealing going on out there. There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on out there. You know, I hope that people, this will open up people's eyes. I hope this opens up the mayor's eyes and maybe he'll get things done, start getting things done. You know, that's a bad area over there.
I've heard of the jungle. It's been around for about 20 years, probably a little more. It was dangerous 20 years ago. It's still dangerous. You know, when they do the one-night count, they don't even go in there. So we never really truly get an accurate count of how many people are truly homeless on the streets after all the shelters are full. When you're homeless and all the shelters are full, you have nowhere to go. Okay. Personally, me, I never went up there, but I stayed in a park on the east side because that was the safest place I could hide as a woman because it's dangerous to be homeless.
Those were the voices of Real Change vendors, Darcy Day, Nick Maxwell, and Susan Russell. Even before this week's shooting in the jungle, the city was rethinking its policies on homelessness. Yesterday on this program, Q13 analyst C.R. Douglas described the case that Mayor Ed Murray is making.
The system for delivering homeless services is broken.
How so?
The city contracts out with all kinds of different providers, and it is too fragmented. It's too wrought with politics. We have too many programs that aren't proving their worth. We're spending $50 million a year at the city level, and the problem is only getting worse, not better. He says, and we will see if this plays out, that he wants to overhaul the system, change it, make it work.
How hard would that be?
Very hard.
Why?
Because he didn't say this, but you hear people whisper this. We have a homeless service industrial complex. We have an ingrained bureaucracy. And I'm not talking about the city bureaucracy necessarily. I'm talking about all these nonprofits that really do the lion's share of the services. We contract out. And all those different agencies, and there are dozens, probably 100, are providing different services. They've all got their own sort of executive.
What are we
director.
Talking? Meals?
Meals.
Shelters?
Shelters.
Counseling?
Counseling.
Mm.
Job referral programs. Mm. You know, long-term housing, short-term housing, overnight housing, you name it. Veterans housing, family housing, women's housing, all kinds of stuff. But it's very fragmented, and it's fraught with a lot of entrenched interests. They've been around for a long time. They've got a lot of sway at City Hall. And you get a system which has grown up to have a lot of inefficiencies in it. And the mayor is admitting that very publicly. And he's unlikely to get a ton more money from the feds and the state. He may, we'll see. But he has the power to change how the city spends the $50 million it does annually. And if he can wring a lot of inefficiencies out of the system, we could get better outcomes and hopefully avoid things like last night.
That's Q13 analyst C.R. Douglas. This morning, I asked Mayor Ed Murray why our homeless service system is so ineffective. He said we tend to fund programs based on a well-meaning inertia.
They sound good. It's a good social service agency. It's a good nonprofit. But the outcomes may not be good. And it is going to be pretty difficult and challenging for the council to stick with us in what we're calling a portfolio model, where we're going to fund services that are connected to outcomes, which means we're going to have to stop funding other services. And as you know, every program has a group of advocates attached to it, and that becomes politically very difficult for folks.
It sounds hard to change. How are you going to change it?
Well, we have already begun over the last year a series of efforts of focusing money on those agencies that are reducing homelessness, and actually slowly phasing out some funds for some programs that clearly the results are abysmal. But when we get to budget time and we make those dramatic moves in the fall, I think it'll be a very difficult discussion. You know, what happens is the council chambers fill up with folks advocating that we not cut anything and shift the money anywhere, that we just fund everything. And that debate is one that's difficult because the city is less and less able to continue to spend its money on just homelessness.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray on the challenge of reforming how the city deals with homelessness. Now, sometimes it's hard to get your head around the size and scope of the homelessness problem. The one-night count is a tool we can use to do that. The one-night count gives us a snapshot of how many people are unsheltered on our streets on a single night, and it's happening tonight. Actually, early tomorrow morning between 2 and 5 a.m. Hundreds of volunteers will walk the streets of King County counting people who are unsheltered. The agency responsible for the one-night count is All Home King County, and its director, Mark Putnam, says we need to know the level of unmet need.
They're in tents, they're in cars, they're in emergency rooms, they're riding the bus all night. I talked to a gentleman just this past week who prefers not to be in shelter and rides the bus every night. You know, this is the population that is often the hardest to reach, those that are unsheltered. They're often more likely to have mental illness and chemical dependency issues that keep them in a cycle of being on the street. And so we need to make sure that we're not just thinking about those that have the wherewithal to come for services and participate in our programs, but that we're identifying that unmet need and then tailoring our programs to make sure that we're doing more for them.
How accurate is the one-night count?
It's definitely an estimate. So a number of things limit our ability to get a true sort of census. People have to be found. They have to be seen. King County is one of the larger counties geographically in the country. So we can't get everywhere, but we do fan out and capture as much of the county as we can. But there are limitations to that.
Help me picture that interaction. The homeless one-night count volunteer does what? Just walks around with a clipboard? Are they interacting with the people they're counting?
Typically not. People are sleeping. So I've done the count, you know, obviously a number of times. Last year I was in Bellevue, so I'll describe that experience. So we had a team of five of us. We had flashlights. One of us had a clipboard with a tally. If we saw somebody sleeping on a bench, we noted that they were sleeping on a bench. If we saw somebody in a tent, you know, we checked that box. Typically, you can't tell whether they are male or female. But if you can tell that, then you would note that as well. We're not waking people up. We're not shining the flashlight on the tent. We're very discreet about what we're doing.
But do you ever feel like you're invading someone's privacy anyway, even if it's for a good reason?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, it's somebody walking into your front yard, into your house, into your space. They are in the uncomfortable, dangerous situation of living in public. And so definitely we do feel like that. But we also feel like it's incredibly important. It's an important tool for us to understand the need, to make the case to our federal and state partners for the amount of need that we have. And, you know, it drives decision making and our advocacy.
How does this number help us address the problem of people who don't have a place to live?
It helps us identify the gap we still need, you know, that many more resources. And then those measures drive, policy decisions around, in order to make homelessness more rare, we need to reduce the number of newly homeless people that come into our county each year. We have about 50% of the number of people that were homeless last year in King County that hadn't been homeless here before. So We need to reduce that flow, address the causes of homelessness, which are lack of housing affordability and mental health. And, you know, I could go on. So a lot of different causes. The data really drives the actions that are taken throughout the year.
Somebody might listen to this conversation, say, wait, so we've been doing the 1-9 count for years.
Yeah.
A lot of counting.
Yeah.
And there's more, we see more and more homeless people in King County. So what makes us think this is doing us any good?
I hear you. So, like, what's the point? Like, why do we keep doing this? I think each one of those people count, right, as somebody that we need to house. And I think each year it is an opportunity for us to raise awareness. You know, some of this, these counts and the advocacy does lead to victories of that lead to housing and services for people experiencing homelessness. So we do see the incremental progress. And we need more people to pay attention and to believe that all people deserve a home. And we think with that foundation that it'll lead to more people being housed if more people have that belief.
You ever have a memorable interaction, encounter with someone you're counting?
I remember last year in Bellevue, out of the corner of our eye, we saw a bench that was right under a street light, incredibly bright, right outside a bank, I think, in downtown Bellevue. And a man laying there, no blanket, just laying there at, you know, 3:34 in the morning on that bench, and I think under the light. And it just struck us that the reason he was there under the light was for safety, you know, and that he had nothing with him. He didn't have a backpack. He had his head on the bench, and he had no blanket. So I mean, I think, you know, I can still picture him. I think everybody has a story like that that does the count. I think it sticks with them, and we hope drives home the importance of addressing this issue.
That is Mark Putnam, director of All Home King County, the agency responsible for tonight's 1-night count. We'll have the results of the count for you on KUOW tomorrow morning. Last year, they counted nearly 4,000 people in King County, 2,800 of those in Seattle. Putnam says he hopes the number will go down this year, but that seems unlikely. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. Iowa's presidential primary caucus is 4 days away, and the national opinion polls suggest voters are feeling fearful, anxious, and angry, especially on big issues like the economy, national security, and America's changing demographics. Well, to gauge voters' mood here in Washington, we talked to the chairs of the state Republican and Democratic parties. Democratic Party Chair Jackson Raven says Republicans are exploiting Americans' fears.
They want to tell us that refugees are scary, that Muslims are scary. And in the Democratic Party, we don't buy into that kind of un-American cynicism. They're kind of hand-wringing and you know, their naysaying about national security is just not helpful. And, you know, we understand that leveraging our diplomatic might is more important than flexing our military muscle. So we need to go back and think also a little bit about where this insecurity came from in the first place and who destabilized the Middle East, if we're talking specifically about where some of the challenges are today. A lot of what we're experiencing and what we're struggling with today is a result of the power vacuum that happened in Iraq. And the Republican messaging about refugees and about Muslims doesn't do anything to make that situation any better. It's posing. But, well, I think Americans are smarter than this, and that they're going to reject this political cynicism and understand that the work that we're doing is important and that there are, you know, healthier and better ways to move forward. If you listen to President Obama during his recent State of the Union address, he talked about hope and optimism and faith, and that, you know, the hearts of the American people are more powerful than that doom and gloom that we're hearing from the Republican Party about national security.
if the Republican message is one of fear, how much effect is it having, do you think? What's your take on how fearful Washington State residents really are, separate from what you think they're being told?
Well, in terms of, you know, the Democrats that I'm seeing across the state, I am definitely not seeing a lot of issues and conversations that are coming forward about, you know, us having to, you know, build a wall between Mexico and us having to deny Muslims, you know, the ability to enter, Muslims or, you know, the ability to enter this country or to refuse refugees, you know, help and support. That is not, you know, Democrats are not talking about that at all, you know, just the opposite. And so I don't think that kind of doom and gloom, that kind of fear mentality is really driving the way that Democrats, one, view the world, and two, it's not the kind of world we want to live in and that we believe we live in.
Jackson Ravens chairs Washington State's Democratic Party, and he's telling you about the voter mood in our state around the issue of national security. We're going to talk in about 10 minutes to the chair of the Washington State Republican Party, Susan Hutchison. And what about you? How are you feeling about national security in this election year? Call and tell us about it at 206-221-3663. 221-3663. Or join our conversation on Twitter. Use the hashtag #electionfeels. KUOW Seattle. This is Bill Radke. Good afternoon. The U.S. military has a surplus program. So they take equipment that they're not using anymore and they give it to local police departments. Well, last spring, the Obama administration ordered some of that military surplus to be returned. This came in the wake of accusations that local police departments were getting too militarized. So the federal government wants the return of all vehicles that run on a tracked system instead of wheels. That's right, tanks. The feds also want their weaponized aircraft back and their 50 caliber ammunition and their grenade launchers. Well, the truth is Washington State never got any of those. No tanks, no weaponized aircraft, no grenade launchers. We just got bayonets. Yeah. The weapons you've seen from World War I, and now the federal government wants our bayonets too. KUOW's military affairs reporter Patricia Murphy is here to explain. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Bill.
Really? Bayonets? Have local law enforcement been using bayonets?
Well, these are bayonets. Actually, they are designed to be mounted on weapons. They're for close combat that the military trains for. And yes, we have about 60 bayonets that have been distributed around the police departments here in Washington State. I spoke to someone at the Walla Walla Police Department. They use these things for their tactical response team, their SWAT guys. They use them to cut rope. It's not a very exciting assignment for the bayonets. They have packed them up and returned them to the federal government. It's worth noting, though, Washington State has 13 mine-resistant vehicles and 16 armored trucks.
So if the intent is to demilitarize local police departments, why can departments keep their armored vehicles that can rip down a house, but they can't keep their bayonets?
You know, this is kind of the funny thing about this whole thing, and it's really the politicalization of the militarization argument. You know, if you see tracks, maybe that screams militarization. If you see a mine-resistant vehicle with actual wheels on it, maybe not so much. It seems strange, yes. A lot of police departments make the argument that these are very important parts of their force that they would never be able to afford.
Is this just for show, then?
It perhaps is a little bit for show. There are, moving forward, more stringent controls being put on distributing these mine-resistant vehicles. But it's also worth noting that this surplus program is a good deal for the military, because disposing of vehicles that are designed to not be destroyed is almost impossible.
Keep the tanks, so long bayonets.
Yep.
KOW's military affairs reporter Patricia Murphy, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Now, let's talk about the fear of crime at a local level, since we're talking about militarization of police departments. There are neighborhoods in Seattle where people are so concerned about their security that they have banded together to hire private police. This is happening in the affluent neighborhoods of Magnolia, Queen Anne, Ballard. Reporter Jessica Lee is tracking this trend for the Seattle Times, and she told me many of the residents are frustrated by crime and by police response times near their homes.
In a lot of these neighborhoods, residents are feeling unsafe. They're feeling as though the city's police force is not having a strong enough presence in their neighborhood, and they have the means necessary to change that, to ease their minds. And so They are hiring, whether it be off-duty police officers, SPD officers, or these private security personnel to increase patrolling in their neighborhood. And it seems to be easing a lot of people's minds. They say that it is deterring criminals. They're seeing crime rates go down. However, statistically showing that is a little bit trickier.
Well, let me ask you, we've had wealthy neighborhoods and fears of crime for a long, long time. Why do we see more of this hiring of private security forces?
Sure. Well, the direct correlation is a little bit hard to draw, but I mean, there is definitely, at the same time, this movement coming or this this push from residents to bump up policing, to boost staffing at the city level. They feel as though right now SPD is not cutting it for them. They say that with this new population, this bigger population, these crimes are just escalating. And then, therefore, they need to take matters into their own hands to hire these patrols.
And what's the reality? Are crimes, break-ins, drug use, is this going up, up, up?
I think that's the question that many people ask. And even the mayor, you know, is coming to this question of perception versus reality, right? Statistically, if you look at the last 5 years of property-related theft in these three neighborhoods, there was not a dramatic spike last year. The number of crimes, of these sorts of crimes, are going up since 2010, but there's not the level of intensity as maybe some residents think.
So you alluded to reasons why there might be a perception of increased danger in some of these neighborhoods. By the way, we're talking, what, Ballard, Magnolia,
Queen Anne.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think there is this heightened perception these days of danger and crime?
Police are telling us that crime is going down. Over 2015, they're citing an early estimate of a 10% decrease overall in the city for crime. But then you have these large and extreme frustrations from these residents in these neighborhoods that you cited saying, no, that's not so much the case. And so there's this disconnect here. And so trying to figure out why that may be, one of the topics that came up in several interviews as I was reporting this story is social media is another method, a new method for reporting that many people are going to. It's no longer the case like it was a decade ago when you have your car broken into, you call 911, you call an officer, and you have it formally reported, and that report then stays within the police department. Well, now most people are going online, they're sharing what happened to them, they're posting videos. If my neighbor reports a car prowl, my car gets broken into, we're going to go back and forth on social media, it's going to get shares, and now more people who would not necessarily know that that is happening to both me and my neighbor, they're going to know that this is happening, and then their level of awareness is heightened as well.
So this idea of if you can afford it, you've got this extra protection around you. What could that mean for the ideal of equality in our city?
That's something that many people have brought forward since the story has published, and I have no answer to that other than, you know, if you are a resident who has the means to hire this type of personnel to ease your mind, you're feeling unsafe, strong and emotional concerns, then there's nothing stopping you. I think the question is this hiring a result of an overworked police department, of staffing levels not where they should be? And those are the types of questions that should move forward and be answered.
Jessica Lee is a staff reporter for the Seattle Times. This morning, I asked Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray what he thinks of this trend toward private policing.
Well, I think it's unfortunate. And if you look at those neighborhoods that have significant issues of crime, they're not the neighborhoods who can afford to hire private security guards. Now, there has been, and there was a problem with policing when I became mayor. I tell you, the police force is pretty demoralized and had pretty mixed signals about what they were supposed to do. We have a new chief over a year now. She's brought on a new command staff. And based on the data that she shares with me on a weekly basis, crime is actually coming down in Seattle. Now, some crime, particularly property crime-related cars, we're still struggling with. But crime generally is coming down. I also realize that some of the neighborhoods that have a sense that crime is rising when it's actually not are the same neighborhoods who often are using extensive social media tools that monitor crime.
So let's say some people in Magnolia or Queen Anne are hiring security guards and they don't really need them. So what? What's wrong with that?
Well, if that's how they want to spend their money, they can spend their money that way.
Well, you called you said the trend was unfortunate.
A campaign that we would increase the number of officers over attrition by 104 years. We're on target to do that. We now actually have more officers on the street, again, according to what I've been told, than we did when I came into office. We are in a process of evaluating how many more officers beyond that we should add, given that Seattle's growing and growing rapidly. But let me put a caveat on that. Most problems with police forces that we see that nationally where a police officer acts in a way that ends up in some of the problems we have happens in the first 5 years of that officer's career. So we're not going to rush a whole bunch of new young officers on the street. We're going to do this deliberately. We're going to increase it over time. And we're going to be sure that the officers we hire have the skills to deal with some of the very difficult situations out there.
Is when a wealthy neighborhood hires some private security guards, what does that have to do with a poorer neighborhood that can't afford it? Does it hurt that neighborhood at all? Or maybe it helps divert resources to that neighborhood?
Again, the point is, when we look at a city with a fairly low crime rate in most categories, and you look at a city that has to decide where policing should happen, it should go to neighborhoods that have higher rates of crime. Those generally, not always, but generally, are not Seattle's affluent neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that can afford to buy or pay for their own private security.
But does the private security let the city say, okay, great, you pay for it, we'll divert some of those resources to neighborhoods that need it more?
Absolutely not. We do not take, I will not, and the chief will not, make decisions about where we put police based on private security forces. You know, we have a huge problem in this country right now over cops, police officers who aren't trained well enough to deal with difficult situations. And now we're going out there, some neighborhoods, and hiring people to do security that don't even come close to the training that our own officers have. I think that is a recipe for another disaster.
A recipe for another disaster. That was Seattle Mayor Ed Murray reacting to the trend of wealthier neighborhoods hiring private security guards. Well, at least there's something you can do about security in your neighborhood. When it comes to national security, those forces are even farther beyond your control, and that makes some voters anxious. National candidates like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are speaking to Americans' anxieties and fears and anger. To find out how voters here are feeling, we talked to the state Democratic Party chair a few minutes ago. Now here's the state Republican Party chair, Susan Hutchison. She says Republican voters have good reason to worry about national security.
Paris. You have a situation in Paris, and suddenly people think, I could have been in a concert hall. My kids could have been in that concert hall if that had been in the U.S., if that had been in our city. And so that's where there's a personal identity. It's a human nature thing where we look at victims and we say, that could have been me. So when San Bernardino occurred and you had a situation where a couple, where the office mates had even thrown them a shower a few months earlier for the birth of their new baby, and that same couple came in and gunned them down, The horror of it is unspeakable, but that sense that, wow, if that could happen to them, it could happen to me too. And so there's this sense of do something. We've got to have leadership in this country that cares enough to protect me and protect my fellow workers or my family from anything like this that could happen. And so just today I was hearing on the radio, you hear it all the time, about more threats out of ISIS, that they're producing videos to let the world know that they're on the move and to expect more attacks. And so again, people wonder, is that coming to my neighborhood? Is that coming to my city?
Is it fair to characterize that as fear? Are voters afraid?
I think they're afraid. And I do think that they are. They've gotten to this sense as they have seen multiple examples that it is time. It is time to do something about this so that I can be assured that my life is not going to turn upside down. See, one of the things that people want is they want predictability, and they don't want to have to be fearful in everything that they do. And so we need to know that the government is taking care of the real threats that are affecting us and allowing people of diversity to live among each other safely.
So this concern, this fear, the desire for predictability, how does that feeling compare to recent years, recent elections?
I think people question the commitment of the federal government to keep us safe. When 9/11 occurred and we saw President Bush respond and then the Congress follow, there was a sense that we will never let this happen again. I don't think that's the feeling people have now. And it's been a number of years later. We're now 15 years since 9/11. And so we have people who are now voting age who were little when that happened, and they don't remember it. So as time goes on, world events change. The administration, the Obama administration has, as you know, been unable to even name the threat against us. They have only recently embraced the word terrorism without defining what kind of terrorism it is. And so that lack of definition has allowed citizens to wonder whether or not the federal government really cares about us.
Are you getting at, is this related to when Donald Trump talks about political correctness? Is this
absolutely yes? And I think you're touching on it, that one of the mood changes that's occurred in this election is that people are fed up with folks not telling the truth or not calling it what it is. And if anyone defines, you know, sort of no holds barred lack of political correctness, it's definitely Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, who, by the way, apparently will not debate on Fox tonight unless he suddenly changes his mind. That was Susan Hutchison, chair of the Washington State Republican Party, talking about the mood of the voter on some of the big issues in this state going into the 2016 election. That's the Republican perspective. And we heard from the chair of the state Democratic Party earlier this hour, Jackson Ravens. And what about you? How are you feeling about national security or other issues this election year? Give us a call. Tell us at 206-221-3663. That's 221-3663. We've been playing your comments and your stories. And you can join us on Twitter. We're having this conversation with the hashtag #ElectionFeels. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's liberal ideas are a kind of illness that needs to be quarantined. That's how Republican Senator Michael Baumgartner of Spokane sees it. He's proposing the state prohibit cities and towns from setting their own employment laws, like wages, hours, sick leave, and parental leave. So, for example, in the future, Spokane and Everett could not raise their minimum wage the way Seattle and SeaTac did. Senator Baumgartner says the state needs to nip Seattle progressiveness in the bud.
Well, we've seen sort of a creep of radical leftism from the city council level that is kind of the tail wagging the dog on economic and labor and wage rate policy across the state, and frankly, it needs to be stopped. Cities are not a great place to make wage and labor laws. They're too small geographically, and they don't really have the enforcement divisions that they need. And so I'd like to move those decisions to the state level or to the county level as sort of a geographic compromise.
Why are cities too small to make wage and labor laws?
Well, because cities tend to be concentrated with one political view, and yet they have bigger impacts than just the city confines. It's sort of like at the federal level, we have interstate commerce regulated to the feds, realizing that the states themselves would create a system that might not work and be compatible with each other. And that's why within the state or the intrastate level, it should really be at the state level or at the county level, because it's very difficult for a business to have five different wage and labor rates to keep track of. It just doesn't work. It's not efficient.
You call this a Seattle quarantine bill. Why do you call it that?
Well, because, you know, we have a very radical leftist takeover of the Seattle City Council, and we have some what I call mini-me's popping up across the state, particularly we've just had it in Spokane, where we have organized labor, particularly SEIU, adopting a city-by-city strategy to sort of plow into city council races and then get these labor changes. And so that's where we need to stop it now, because we can't have wannabe Kashama Sawants impacting our state's overall economy.
But it's not really a Seattle issue, right? You would stop any city from making decisions about sick leave or employee retention.
That's right. It would move to the county level. The Seattle gets more people's attention. Of course, that's where the most concern is, with the radical left turn of the kind of the socialist bent of labor law.
Yeah, it gets more people's attention. So I wonder, it's not really a Seattle quarantine, but are you just displaying to your Spokane Republicans how anti-Seattle you are?
No. This is a part of the discussion of what wage and labor rates should be across the state, and it really is a Sawant and organized labor driving the discussion across the state. Of course, where we see the most egregious radical left turn is in Seattle, and you know, there are really two economies in this state. What happens in Seattle and the cost of living, the wage rates there, are much different than the rest of the state. You know, in Spokane and Eastern Washington, we have a real competitive disadvantage with the wage and labor rates of Idaho across the border, and that's a reality. People can complain that they don't like Idaho, but we have a cost of doing business at least 30% cheaper just across the border, and that has a real impact for us, and that's something that Seattle doesn't face.
But what about taking away local control? One Spokane lawmaker said to you, if you want to be a city councilman, run for city council.
Well, it's just, again, at the federal level, there's things that bigger geographies do better. And currently in the Seattle City Council, they're engaging in labor law, which they're prohibited with regards to Uber, which they're prohibited from doing. That's at the federal level, yet they're attempting it anyway. So, you know, there's been discussion that we would move this all the way to the Olympia level. But really, I think the county level is a good geographic compromise on this.
But every city does have different conditions, right? Local businesses and workforces might want different rules?
Yes, that's true. But also, you're burdening business with 5 or 10 different wage and labor rates, which doesn't work very well. And cities like Spokane don't have an enforcement division. They're going to have to hire 5 or 10 more employees to enforce these wage and labor rates that they're not equipped to do. So then you're looking at potential property tax increase to fund that. So it's better to keep it at the state level, or again, as a geographic compromise, go to the county level. I mean, it wouldn't mean that you couldn't have different wage and labor rates. I mean, if King County, under my bill, if King County wanted to do something, they could do it and still encapsulate, and the people of Seattle could participate at the county level, or if it were to go to the state level. There's no shortage of Seattle area Democrats in Olympia representing their constituents, but again, it recognizes that it shouldn't be on the city level.
Senator Michael Baumgartner, Republican of Spokane. You might associate Republicans with favoring local control, but he's proposing state legislation to ban cities and towns from setting employment laws like wages, hours, sick leave, and parental leave. The bill has a public hearing on Monday. And we'll be talking about that more on this show tomorrow, that and other topics, when our Friday Week in Review guests include former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, journalist Joni Balter, economist Paul Guppy. That's tomorrow at noon on KUOW. Thanks for joining us on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle Archdiocese recently released 77 names of clergy who have admitted to sexually abusing minors, or the Archdiocese found allegations against them to be established or credible. Some of the clergy on that list are priests who worked on reservation land. The Catholic Church has had a presence on Indian reservations since the 1800s. Their missionary work was intertwined with early U.S. government policy toward Native Americans.
When priests showed up on Native lands to establish missions, the kids were subjected to abuse, just like their parents were subjected to violence and subjugation by army and military personnel.
That's attorney Vito Dela Cruz. He represents many victims of abuse by Catholic clergy in the Northwest, particularly Native American victims. He says this country's history has left American Indians especially vulnerable to this abuse.
In comes a church, in comes a missionary, and they establish these locations where they're supposed to minister to the people. But the history of this country has promoted the stripping of natives of all of the things that are important to them, including their religion and faith. And that was done with the complicity and the participation of the Catholic Church and other religions as well. And you have these representatives of the church who ostensibly and are advertised to speak for God, and then you have those people abusing kids across generations. You take an extremely vulnerable population and overlay it with sexual abuse by divine authority, almost. It is a profound trauma.
And then let's remember why some of these priests and nuns were there on those reservations in the first place.
On the reservation, you have, as I mentioned before, a very isolated population. And when folks got moved to the reservation, they often were problem priests, problem nuns, who did not necessarily have any other place to go other than to the most remote part of Montana or into the rural areas of Washington or into the native villages up in Alaska, so that they could be removed as far away from society as possible. That's one of the ways that the church dealt with it. Even after they were subjected to some kind of therapy, because these treatment centers were established by the Catholic Church in various locations going back into the 40s and 50s. But what they did after they went there for whatever treatment they received, they would send them back to the reservation. It did nothing but exacerbate the problem, because it created a whole new pool of victims for those people to abuse.
And how has the church responded to those allegations?
Well, until recently, with the installation of Pope Francis, they've not had a very good track record for responding to those allegations. And look at what happened recently with the release of the names from the Seattle Archdiocese. They named priests, but those weren't all of the abusers. Teachers or deacons who were members of the church, they also engaged in sexual abuse of kids. Those names have not been released. And the church's response, for the most part, was to hide, to protect its assets, to protect its priests, and essentially short-circuit the entire criminal prosecution of all of these people.
How much do you think this kind of sex abuse goes on today in reservations?
I think with the spotlight that has been thrown on it, the incidences may not be as easily detected. But what I fear is that it still goes on with the same manipulation of the authorities with respect to who gets reported, who gets prosecuted. You got to keep in mind, a lot of the reservations are somewhat isolated, and we have abysmal economic and social conditions, very high unemployment rates, very high dropout rates, suicide rates, those things that make the community much more vulnerable. And a vulnerable community is less apt to speak up when something like this happens.
How big is the Catholic community among Northwest Native American tribes in 2016?
Oh, my. I think it's fairly substantial. For the longest time, this is, again, going back to history, for the longest time, there was a governmental program to strip families of their kids and put them in boarding schools. So we're talking about several generations from the early 1900s all the way through the 1960s and late 1960s when kids were still being put into boarding schools forcibly. So it's there.
Attorney Vito Dela Cruz is with us talking about these allegations, the fallout, continuing stories still being told about Catholic Church sexual abuse. We talked last week with a spokesperson for the Seattle Archdiocese, and he told us that sexual abuse is not just a Catholic problem, that in fact it happens at a similar rate outside the church, that the Catholic Church mirrors the rest of society. What do you say to that?
I think that's fundamentally wrong. Amongst Catholic priests and religious order members, there is an overriding requirement of celibacy that creates a whole lot of different problems for the men and the women who become Catholic nuns or priests. I agree with the statement that sexual abuse occurs in other religious orders, but I don't think that the issue of celibacy is as strong in those denominations as it is with the Catholic Church. We have men and women who are programmed into these careers as priests and nuns from a very young age, and that leads to a whole series of problems when it comes to relating with young people. So I agree with only part of that statement. I think the evidence is there that it's much more prevalent within the Catholic Church.
I wonder where you see the legacy of this sexual abuse on reservation lands today.
It is not just a dark cloud, but it is a profound, profound wound. It's a cross-generational wound that a lot of the Native folks have endured. When that fundamental trust between a layperson and a priest or a nun has been violated in the most gross way imaginable, the scars that people endure lead to other scars and other problems. There are issues with alcoholism and drug abuse, domestic violence, violence in general. I mean, the suicide rates on Native lands are abnormally and absurdly high. So I think it's an enduring legacy, one that's going to take a long time to repair. It's going to take a lot of effort on the part of the Native communities to heal themselves and to find the means necessary to do that for their populations and for their members.
And so hard to extricate that from the history of injustice we're talking about in the first place.
How can you? I mean, it's so related. It is part of the fabric in many ways of what many of these Indian kids had to deal with.
Attorney Vito Dela Cruz, he has represented victims of abuse by Catholic clergy in the Northwest. Right now, he's representing 37 plaintiffs against the Great Falls Diocese in Montana, including Native Americans from the Crow and Cheyenne reservations. Dela Cruz is also handling several claims against a priest in the Yakima Diocese. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow, noon, for KUOW's Week in Review.